and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We are talking about the NBA. Joining us from Boston is Jackie McMullen. Hi, Jackie. How are you?
I am good, Brian. Thank you for asking.
And joining us, are you in Dallas? I forgot to ask you, McMahon.
Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City. Oh, no.
Home of the old pink parrot.
Oh, no.
That's not good.
Don't try to get in hold of McMahon anytime before noon tomorrow.
Not true. I've got a noon flight.
We are recording this on Thursday afternoon. And the reason I want to say that is because John Beilein, I'm sure, before tonight's game, will be speaking about some of the stuff that happened, with his team. So we're going to be a little bit behind what Beilein says publicly. And so that, just to keep in mind. But it was a very strange situation, obviously, that happened, that became public late Wednesday, about something that he said in a film session. He said, he pretty much admitted, I think, that he said in a film session that the Cavs had been playing like thugs. And he wanted to clarify, and apparently did clarify individually to the players that he didn't mean to say thugs. He meant to say slugs. And from what I understand, there was quite a dramatic blowback within the team, which I'll talk about in a minute. And that Beilein's tenure with the Cavs was tenuous, at least for a number of hours. Now it appears that the Cavs have decided that this is not going to be a fireable offense. Jackie, this is a multifaceted situation. Right. This is unusual for a number of different things. I mean, things get said in film sessions all of the time. I assume offensive things get said in film sessions all of the time. But and Woj has pretty much had this story from the start. But what do you make of all of this?
Well, with a different coach, with a different team, in a different situation, you say thugs, and then later you say, oh, man, thugs. I meant slugs, and maybe it just goes along. But there's problems in Cleveland, and it's not because they're losing. Everybody knew they were going to lose. Beilein just hasn't been a great fit there. And I've been around the Cavs more than I care to admit. I've crossed paths with them a few times this year for various reasons. And the last time I was through was, I think, around Thanksgiving, and or maybe later than that. But anyway, there was just an underlying feeling of discontent, too collegey. I remember Paul Pierce saying that once about – actually, it was Doc for like a day. He said that. Too collegey. You know, Doc was slipping him notes under the door, and Paul Pierce is like, too collegey. I don't need that. I don't need that. And I think that's what I was hearing from some of these Cleveland Cavaliers players. And there was talk of practice on Christmas Day. My goodness, if you're not going to play on Christmas Day, you're certainly not supposed to be practicing on Christmas Day. So just not quite grasping the nuances of the pro game, perhaps. Actually, I'm not even sure if practicing on Christmas Day is a nuance. So I think Beilein's been a little under siege there. I think he has not... I don't think I'm telling anybody anything they don't know. He hasn't captured the hearts of the veterans on that team.
That's understatement.
Right, exactly. So I think, again, if you were a different coach in a different situation, this can easily be taken care of, and we're not hearing about it today. But there's other issues. And the issue is that a number of Cleveland Cavalier players just feel like their coach is overmatched, and this is not a good fit for him. Not that he doesn't know basketball, because clearly he does. He has a wonderful resume, college resume. But guys, we've seen this before. It's a hard transition to go from the college to the pros. And you better be ready if you're going to do it. And you better be willing to adjust to the players, something that's a very different concept than when you're a college coach.
And this is, I mean, like you said, this is gasoline on the fire. The fire was already burning. I mean, Kevin Love basically has openly revolted against his coach. I mean, he's protesting play calls in the middle of the floor for everybody to see, to the point where he even admit, yeah, you know, that was a bit much. And it's this awkward situation where you know, they wanted kind of, I think they hired him because they wanted sort of a college type of atmosphere, because for that franchise ever to get right again, they're going to have to develop guys who barely spent any time in a college. You know, basically they've got to develop their college age kids. But yikes. I mean, what a rough fit it is as far as, I don't know, 4.5 years left on that contract. Good luck with that. This is ugly.
Well, you know, Brian, some other things aside from what we just discussed that I've heard throughout the league, because everybody's watching. And again, I don't know John Beilein very well. I'm not going to impinge his character, but I will tell you that there's been little dribs and drabs of they're not that organized, that you would, you know, that they're not prepared in the way you think a coach would be, especially a coach, again, taking this gigantic leap from college to the pros. And, you know, they have some guys that have been around a long time, J.B. Bickerstaff being one of them. He's been around a long time. And so, you know, I'm sure that he is filling in a lot of the gaps and a lot of the holes. But it is a young roster, and some of them don't know any different, right? They don't know. I mean, how does Darius Garland know what it's supposed to be like? He's never been in this situation before. And so that's not good either. Kevin Porter Jr., yeah, same thing.
It's a bifurcated roster. They have some veterans, and there's basically, frankly, some legacy players left over from the LeBron days. And this is one of the things that happened with J.R. Smith last year. Not that I want to say that, you know, J.R. Smith is the person you want to hold up as the, you know, not that it wasn't J.R.'s fault, but J.R. had a real problem with the transition from the old ways to focusing on the new players. And it became an issue with Kevin Love. It became an issue with Channing Frye. But the thing about this is, you're very right, is that if this coach had capital with the players, something like this probably wouldn't be that big of a deal, even if it did irritate them. Right. But he has no capital with them. Mm-hmm. And they made an issue of it. I mean, I don't know if I would say it was rising to the level of mutiny, but they made an issue of it because they don't like him.
And not only does he not have capital with them, he doesn't have capital in the NBA, period. You know, for example, trust me, Rick Carlisle, I know of one film session early on last year in particular where, you know, he really pissed off some of the Mavericks, and some of those guys, you know, they had just gotten there or whatever. But Rick Carlisle is a proven NBA championship coach, you know, where this is a guy who, you know, all he's done is had a really rough half of a season in the NBA. So there's no – and you know, also there is the clear racial connotations takes this in a whole different – realm. But like,
although I will say this in his defense, again, just listening to the comments from the players, I don't think it was this egregious racial slur. Okay, I think what happened was the players all walked out of there. What did he just say? You know, that kind of thing. And then you go out together and you all start talking about it, and you're like, "Wow, that."
Yeah,
difference. I don't think Beilein meant any harm here.
I agree.
But that's intent.
That's a word that, you know, there's a reason he's been so apologetic, because that's not a word that's appropriate to use, especially in that kind of context. It's just, there's nothing good about that. And look, the one good thing that we can say here is at least soup was not served in this film session, because then things really could have gotten ugly.
Right. Well, you know, Kevin Love, let's put it this way. So the Cavs have lost 5 in a row. This game that they have in Detroit starts a 6-game road trip. They go out west after this game, and their next 3 games after this are at the Nuggets and then a back-to-back against the 2 LA teams. By the way, talk about a gauntlet that now exists in the NBA. So many teams, especially Eastern Conference teams, but even some Western Conference teams, come and play both LA teams right in a row. They just stay in LA.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases, they're playing in back-to-backs. Now, the Knicks, I was just at the Knicks-Lakers game the other night. The Knicks played on Sunday and Tuesday, so they got at least one day respite. But, you know, the Cavs, are playing both of them back to back. Can you imagine, like, just coming in? I mean, the Lakers and Clippers are going to win and bash a lot of these teams who come through. That's a real gauntlet that I can't remember happening because they used to always play them.
Do they have a day off in LA before the back to back? Because that's like the worst case scenario.
They do, and then they have 2 days in LA after that before going to Memphis. So my guess is they'll be staying in LA a couple extra days after. Oof. But I'm just saying, like, this situation for the Cavs right now, they just had this issue with Kevin Love. Okay. They traded Jordan Clarkson, and Clarkson's gone in and immediately helped the Jazz. Jazz are 7-0 with Jordan Clarkson. Not that he's the driving force in it, but it certainly bolstered their bench and contributed to how well they've played. But they're in a 5-game losing streak. They've had issues with Love, and now a 6-game road trip out west. So, I'm not expecting good outcomes from this road trip, no matter what. By the way, it's at Detroit, then at Denver, LA. At Memphis, right. At Chicago. So Memphis and Chicago, more winnable games, but who knows what they're
Hey, don't sleep on those Grizzlies. We'll get to them in a minute.
Yeah, so Brian, let me ask you a question. I think Kobe Altman did Beeline solid here because I don't think what he did was a fireable offense, but it would have been the opening perhaps for you to move on from this coach.
Yeah.
How much leeway does John Beilein have with this team?
This is a real problematic situation. Dan Gilbert has always, for whatever reason, wanted to go outside the box with his coaching hires.
Right.
When he hired, he wasn't able to hire Tom Izzo, but you remember. Right. He tried like crazy to get Tom Izzo to be hired. Then after Byron Scott was fired, they ended up hiring in that spot. He offered the job to Bill Self. He went after John Calipari. I mean, Calipari had NBA experience, but he went after John Calipari. He did offer the job to Bill Self right before LeBron came back. Then ended up hiring David Blatt, a European head coach, an American, but a European head coach. And then here he hires John Beilein, not only a college coach, but a 66-year-old college coach.
Right. 5 years, five-year deal? Is that what it is?
I think it was a 4-year guaranteed deal. The crazy thing about that contract, people keep talking about the value, or the length. They didn't actually pay him that much, relatively. I was thinking
it's Gilbert. Of course they don't pay him. Come on, that's redundant. That's redundant.
Well, some coaches have gotten some money out of Gilbert in the past. Tyronn Lue got a huge 5-year contract. Mike Brown got a huge 5-year contract. And since John Beilein was in a very stable situation where he was very successful and could have easily ridden that out to retirement, I would have thought when they hired him, I was like, boy, I'll bet they paid him through the nose. I'll bet they, because, I remember when he offered Izzo the job. I mean, now this is 10 years ago now, but I remember he offered him somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 million a year, which at the time was a huge number in the coaching ranks. And I think he had offered Calipari $10 million a year to be the president and GM or somewhere in the neighborhood of that. So he's offered some big deals before. But Beilein didn't get that type of contract. I think he was getting about $3 million or so a year. I don't have it right in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that's what the number was, give or take. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of a 4-year, $18 million-esque deal. So $3 or $4 million a year and escalates. And then the fifth year, I think, was a team option. But he didn't pay Beilein humongous money. I don't know. I don't know whether that protects him or not, but I would say that, Gilbert, for whatever reason, really wants outside the box coaches. And when David Blatt came over, now granted the scenarios were completely different. David Blatt was coaching a LeBron, Kevin Love, Kyrie Irving team, not this team, but it became very obvious that David Blatt wasn't in the mindset to coach an NBA team. His expectations of the team, what his job was were off. And then I'm kind of surprised they would make another out of the box hire. And here we have the exact same situation, although different circumstances, where, you know, D-line hasn't, you know, after 40 years of coaching college, hasn't adapted. You guys hear us talk about teams and their financial situations when it comes to trades, where they are on the luxury tax, what they have under the cap, what they have under the hard cap, stuff like that. It's our business to know NBA teams' business. But let me ask you about this. How much do you know your business's numbers? How fast can you get them to your fingertips? Can you sprout them off the top of your head like so many NBA teams can? Because if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. And the reason I'm talking to you about this is because of NetSuite by Oracle. They have put together something that helps you solve that exact issue. A lot of companies, by the way, don't have that clear picture of their finances. And it's one of the reasons why businesses fail. And it's a question for any business owner out there. Are you confident that you do have those right numbers when you need them? So if you're a serious entrepreneur or somebody who's on a finance team, you should join so many others in your profession who run NetSuite by Oracle. They're the number one cloud business system in the world. NetSuite offers a full picture of all your finances in one place in real time, right from your phone or your desktop. No more guessing and no more worry that what you don't know could hurt your company. That's why NetSuite customers grow three times faster than the S&P 500, and you can too. So you want to know more about this, you can schedule a demo and receive a free guide, 7 strategies to grow your profits, by checking them out at netsuite.com/hoop. Again, set up your free demo and get that free guide today at netsuite.com/hoop, H-O-O-P. That's netsuite.com/hoop. Moving on from that, Jackie, you were at an interesting game last night, the Spurs.
The sizzling Spurs.
Yeah. Upset the Celtics, a couple of bad losses in a row.
A couple of great wins in a row for the Spurs.
Yeah, like four kind of bad games in a row, too, to be frank. You know, but that's a story for another day.
Well, they have a big game with the 76ers coming up tomorrow, which we won't talk about right now. But I think Celtics 76ers games are – or that's tonight, I guess. It was tomorrow yesterday.
It is tonight, yes.
Yeah, well, Embiid's not playing, so we'll see what happens. But by the way, as a real quick aside, and I realize that there may be an update on this again after this podcast, so I'm acknowledging that we don't know yet. I'm a little bit worried about that Embiid finger. A couple of days of specialists – He heard it and they let him come back in the game.
I like fingers to be pointed in one direction.
Hot take.
I don't like them when they take like a sharp right turn. That's never a great thing.
It isn't, but the line is very long of players who have played with dislocated fingers, with torn ligaments in your fingers.
This is true.
Tim, you know that. You've probably played. I have. I'm not making light of this. Russell Westbrook had dislocated fingers
for the first month or two of the season, and look how well he shot the ball.
Yeah, I'm just saying this might be one of those injuries that you just have to tape it up and suck it up.
Yeah, I'm just telling you, he's going to see some specialists for several days.
No, I know he is.
It's worrisome.
It's worrisome. Everything's worrisome. Everything is always worrisome around the Sixers. It just seems
I saw them. They beat Oklahoma City, who's been playing well right after I saw them. But, you know, I saw them when they'd lost for the fourth straight time. The chemistry's funky. The fit's funky. Spacing's bad. Ben Simmons is playing the wrong position. I mean, there's a lot of issues there.
Then you watch him on Christmas Day just completely dominate the best team in the
league. I know.
I don't know, man. I know.
The same Bucks team that was dominated by the Spurs who spanked the Celtics.
Give it a rest, my man. Give it a rest.
I'm just saying, look at these Spurs.
You need to branch out. Yeah, let's talk about the Spurs.
The eighth seed Spurs, the team that we said, that 22-year playoff streak is – go ahead and bury them, and here they are now. The West is a lot different than previous years.
All right, let me read off the as we sit here today on Thursday afternoon. Let me read off the eighth place, quote unquote, race.
The race for eighth.
For eighth. And he's, so San Antonio is currently in eighth. They're 4.5 back of the Thunder in seventh. So it's pretty much a.
There's seven playoff teams, and then there's seven fighting for the eighth seed, and then there's okay. the 5-time West champs around it.
All right. So eighth place, San Antonio, 16-20. They've won 6 of their last 10, won 2 in a row. Ninth place, Memphis Grizzlies, 16-22. So they played a couple more games.
10 of 16.
Yes, and 3 in a row. So they're tied in the win column, mm-hmm. Which people always focus on the loss column. Like, oh, they're tied in the loss column. When you're below 500, you always pay attention to the win column, not the loss column. So also 16-22, Portland Trailblazers. So essentially, San Antonio, Memphis, and Portland, well, San Antonio's played a couple less games. They're all tied, essentially, for the eighth seed because they've all got 16 wins. Then Sacramento has 15 wins, 15-23, and 11th. Minnesota, 14-22. They are a bizarre team, and they've been playing a G League team recently because of injuries, mm-hmm. essentially. Then Phoenix is hanging back there at 14-23. And then New Orleans, who's won 7 of 10.
Zion's coming back sometime, or coming back, debuting sometime soon?
I would say if there's no setbacks, I was talking to people in New Orleans this week. If there's no setbacks, they want him to have 3 or so practices where mm-hmm. he goes 5-on-5. And if you look at the calendar, you can take a look at maybe around the 20th, 22nd, 24th. They have games in there.
The 20th would be great. They play Ja Morant's Memphis Grizzlies that night.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. But, you know, you have to see how he comes out of these workouts. So still, you know, roughly 2 weeks away would be what I think. But anyway, we're here in mid-January, early January, I guess. And we're still talking about the 14th place team having a chance to make the playoffs. I guess that's a good
thing. But only, yeah, they're only 4 games out. And the, you know, franchise savior, although I know David Griffin doesn't want to call him that, but the franchise savior is yet to play a minute.
Well, they're just playing. They're playing better even without him. So
yeah, Brandon Ingram is hooping. Lonzo Ball has really been playing well lately.
Yeah, he. You know, one of the things they've talked about is that ankle injury that he had last year was so horrific that they felt that it just took him that long to truly be healthy. I mean, I don't know. It's not my ankle. I know that ever since Derek Favors started playing again, you know, he was hurt and then his mother passed away suddenly and it just was devastating to him. And he was just in no position to even think about basketball for a while, but he has gotten back on his feet. And ever since he started playing, they've played a lot better. And I mentioned they've won 7-10. They had a heartbreaking loss the other night to the Jazz where your boy Gobert got away with a foul at the last play and wasn't reviewable. Ingram went to the basket and he got, you know, I was watching it live.
and the Jazz pranced off the floor with all two-time defensive player of the year.
Yeah.
Not two free throws, two-time defensive player of the year.
Yeah. Well, I think Gobert was surprised he didn't get called for it. I think he kind of purposed.
And
anyway,
I promise you what they'll say is, hey, we got hosed on a couple of those type things.
I'm sure they did. But Jackie, the Spurs over the last few games, the Spurs who are very famous for sort of rejecting the three-point revolution and Popovich, you know, just complaining about it a lot. They've actually been shooting more threes. The other night they took 35. They beat the Bucks at home, and I think they took 35 threes, which is off the charts for them. And they've gotten LaMarcus Aldridge. Aldridge was putting up good numbers, but they've actually gotten him to take a couple of steps back and shooting some threes. So I don't know what Pop is saying, and I'm sure you'll tell us. But it's kind of interesting that their little mid-season spike here is and gotten them into eighth place is, you know, somewhat tied to three-point shooting.
Not somewhat. It's very significantly tied to it. And it was the first question I asked Pop last night. And he said that, well, LaMarcus is finally buying in, which suggests that this was the plan all along. And then he was very quick within a minute or two of saying that he's been great. He's been fantastic. He's, you know, he's done everything we've asked. But the first thing he said was he's finally buying in. And you know, you guys know how this works. You pull your big out. He stretches the floor. He starts shooting threes. DeMar DeRozan gets to be DeMar DeRozan, number one, okay? DeMar DeRozan was classic DeMar DeRozan last night in that win over the Celtics. And what I mean by that, you guys know what I mean by that, two-point shots, efficient shots in the paint, pull-up jumpers. He's not a three-point shooter, and I think everyone's just about given up, even hoping he will be. But not only does it do that, you've got all these young guys, Murray and Derek White and Lonnie Walker. When you pull LaMarcus Aldridge away from the basket and he starts shooting those threes, it gives them a chance to create. It gives them a chance to do what they're good at, which is creating, driving the ball. Last night, they shot 67% on two-pointers last night. So they took, I think, 21 threes last night. But it really wasn't them even necessarily hitting the threes that helped them win the game. Really, they bludgeoned the Celtics. It was the spacing and getting these players opportunities to do what they do best. And that's really what it's about. And, you know, if LaMarcus Aldridge is smart, he'll understand how it'll prolong his career too, because he's looked like dead man walking for a good part, I thought, this year. He's slow foot. He looked weighted
down.
But
isn't this Popovich coming out of being a stick in the mud about the point of what all the three-point shooting is the spacing?
Right, but I will tell you that in the context of our conversation, because we were talking about The Death of the Big Man, which is a piece that Kirk and I wrote last, I don't know, was it last week? It feels like a million years ago now. I think it dropped on the site last week. We were talking about it, and he said, Pop said, well, you know, I said, do you think the rule changes? Will the rules ever be changed? Because one of the things people, you know, we talk about the three-point shot. That's the obvious reason why people get away from posting up. But one of the other big reasons is because you can manhandle a guy down in the post, and no one is ever going to call it. But you airbrush J.J. Redick's locks as you go by, and he gets three shots.
And James Harden.
Right, exactly, James Harden. And you know, you can trace it all the way back to when they eliminated hand-checking in 2004. We don't need to go down this rabbit hole. But the point Pop was making, or what I was asking Pop was, you know, if you could get people to enforce the manhandling that goes on in the block and to be a little less stringent about any little bit of contact on the perimeter. In other words, if you could change the rules and make them closer together, would that help with post-up play? And Pop gave the proper answer. No, because it's not what the league wants. The league likes the way the game is being played. The league likes James Harden firing away. And then Pop went on to one of his little rants and said, listen, let's get it over with. Why don't we just have a four-point line and a five-point line? Let's just make it a circus. I mean, let's just come down and let everybody let it fly from 40 feet. People like that? I think it's boring. So, yes, he's doing this, but still somewhat reluctantly.
But awfully effectively. I mean, you look at the last eight games, Aldridge is shooting about 4.5 threes a game. He's shooting at 60% from three-point range. That you know, that, obviously that'll go down, but it's 1 of 5 last night. But it's not even the percentage. It's the threat. It's the same reason that the Mavericks.
Ben Simmons thing that they're begging him. They don't care.
Yes, dude. Right. You have to shoot those shots in the flow of the offense to open the floor. Same reason the Mavericks. You know, they love Porzingis as a spot up guy, even though he hadn't shot it great this year. Because it opens up the floor. By the way, it was kind of funny. There was some manhandling going on in the post last night in Dallas, but it was Nikola Jokic with the ball in his hand. So the post-up play isn't necessarily dead, and it's still a good play when you can get your 285-pound center switched onto a small forward with the game on the line. But
Jokic, right?
Yes. Yeah. He feasted on the Mavericks last night and killed him in the post. But, I mean, to your point, Jackie, this – and LaMarcus, I believe, has another year left on his deal. Him, if he continues embracing shooting the three like this, it's going to get him paid on another deal. I mean, he's going out of whether it's San Antonio or somewhere else. I mean, welcome to the modern NBA. And it's kind of like when Marc Gasol finally started shooting threes in Memphis. It's like, dude, you're a great mid-range shooter. Why are you shooting 20-foot shots? Take a step or two back. And it's just the math is simple.
It is. And to your point, it doesn't, you don't have to necessarily convert on the threes, which they did, you know, last night they took 21 threes. I don't have it in front of me. I think they shot 30 or 31% 3-point line. That wasn't it. It was the way they created opportunities and spacing by doing that for guys like DeRozan, for guys like Derek White, for Lonnie Walker, who seems to be coming on, guys. He was kind of fun to watch last night.
He's hit and miss. I saw what looked like his breakout performance, and that was the whole – you know, dunk that didn't count, game was protested, blah, blah, blah. If the Rockets protest would have gone through it, it would have wiped out like 25% of Lonnie Walker's career scoring at the time.
Oh, no.
Because he blew
that's
up
unfair.
In the fourth. But yeah, well, it didn't. Those still count. But he blew up in the fourth quarter that night. He was awesome defensively on Harden.
There'll
be stretches where he's really playing well and looks like he's earning Pop's trust. And then there'll be a little, you know, 6-minute outing sprinkled in there. But he's
Tim,
interesting.
Tim, he's 21 years old.
And he's playing for Pop.
It was funny last night. There was a funny moment because whenever Popovich comes to Boston, and they've done some renovations to the Garden, if you guys haven't been there for a while. But they always had the old murals, the photographs painted onto the walls. You guys have seen that, right? So Pop is a big fan of John Havlicek, his favorite NBA player. Had a picture of him in his office. It's all a famous story. So whenever he did the pregame, he always would stand under the mural with Havlicek's photo on it. Well, guess what? Those are all gone. It's all been repainted and redone. There's no Havlicek. I don't know who it was, but somebody brought a black and white photograph and taped it up behind Pop's head before the pregame last night. And Lonnie Walker was walking by and to go out
uh-oh.
To the court. And Pop pointed to Havlicek and said, "This is who you're going to have to be like it." And we're all looking at him, and someone, you know, we're like, "Well, he's going to need a haircut." His hair is like 8 feet high.
Didn't Lonnie Walker say something like, who is that?
I didn't hear that.
McDonald tweeted that.
Yeah, if you said that, I did not hear it. But it was just a funny moment.
Well, people are tweaking John Beilein for being from a different era with his players. I mean, there's Pop telling Lonnie Walker he's got to be like John Havlicek.
Right. Give him a pair of chucks and let him go.
So who of these teams, you know, we were just talking on the spot a few weeks ago about whether the Spurs needed to, you know, break apart a little bit. Now they've kind of got it putting the pieces together.
Now they might get to get swept by the Lakers in the first round.
Okay,
but it's extending a historic playoff streak.
But Brian's asking a good question. If you're the Spurs and you can move DeMar DeRozan, even though he's a lovely mid-range player and a great guy by all accounts, would you move him?
You know what? I still would. I don't think San Antonio would, simply because – and Jackie, you talked to the man last night. I'm sure you've got better insight than I would. But I just don't think Pop wants anything to do with a clear-cut rebuild in the middle of, you know, maybe it's his last season, maybe it isn't. Right. We don't know.
Well, there's good. I think they feel like they're on to something here after all. I mean, it's still – relatively early. We've just talked about the fact that
it's not even midseason yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of time left, and I do think what you've seen is just the patience. He's shown more patience than I give him a lot of credit for that. My new favorite hobby when I'm watching Spurs games, and I do watch them occasionally, not always in person, and I did it again last night, is just watching the interaction between Pop and DeJounte Murray. It's highly entertaining. You know, put your hands down. He's like, "But I did." Just listen, you know, it's very entertaining. Because Murray's, you know, the potential, of course, is there, and he's coming off an ACL. They do really have some good young players. Derek White is a good young player. They have some pieces to go forward here. They do.
But you know, you mentioned the Spurs, the Trailblazers. You know, how does this affect their approach going into the trade deadline? How aggressive are they? You know, they've got a couple big expiring contracts.
The Blazers are going to make a big I think the biggest addition at the trade deadline is going to be probably with the Pacers, because they're adding an all-star. Now, I don't know if he's going to be an all-star with Oladipo coming back.
Or the Pelicans. You know, the Pelicans being within sniffing distance, does that affect how aggressively they shop Drew Holiday?
So here's my feel on the Pelicans right now, and I can't emphasize right now harder, because it's still very fluid. And one of the things I'm feeling as I talk to teams, and we're getting to the point in the season, like this is today. So right now it's in the late afternoon on Thursday. Today alone, I've talked to six different executives from six different teams. We're getting to the point where it's really getting into the season where everybody's talking to everybody, including the reporters. Right now, my feel on the Pelicans is they're actually looking to acquire another veteran as opposed to selling off a veteran. If anything, the Pelicans have seen what it made, what a big difference it made to get Derek Favors back. And they think if they could get another veteran into their rotation, that it may even help them more. So again, right now, I feel like I sense from the Pelicans that they're maybe buyers. But that's the one thing I'm feeling. I'm feeling from a lot of teams that, you know, they haven't made up their mind yet. And I want to talk about your Mavericks on that front in a minute here, McMahon. But so which of these teams – oh, anyway, so the Blazers, Nurkic, they're going to get Nurkic back.
Whiteside's a huge expiring contract.
But getting Nurkic back is potentially a huge thing for the Blazers, and I think that's one of the things that the Blazers – again, this is – I apologize that I have to qualify this so hard – but I'm going to have to do it just for aggregation purposes. Right now, I think the message that the Blazers are putting out there is that they're going to stand pat. Doesn't mean that that won't change in 3 weeks, but the word that I've heard is the position that they're saying is, you know, we're going to get Nurkic back and see what we can do. Or if they don't
You're getting Nurkic back. Why would you not try to do something with Whiteside's contract?
Well, I'm just telling you that's the message that I think is being put out there. Now, I don't know if that means they won't do anything or if it means they just won't do a big deal. But that's – I think the Blazers feel right now is they're going to – again, I just said right now again. I'm sorry I can't do it. But I think that they're like, we're going to hold on until Nurkic comes back, and then that they think that they'll be a much improved team, because no move that they could make would be as impactful as getting back this guy who is their road grader, screen setter, and you know he was playing so well before he got hurt. But
a great passer for a big man too.
I have no idea. I mean, I remember when Paul George came back off that broken leg. I mean, he didn't even run right for a while. So I don't know.
It takes time.
So we talked about the Spurs and the Blazers. Grizzlies, Kings, Wolves, Suns.
Grizzlies are a fascinating team to me, and I'm actually about to go to Memphis for a few days this Sunday and into next week. This obviously, they're in a rebuilding process. And kind of going into the season, you thought, okay, best case scenario for the Grizzlies is going to be they take their lumps this year. That's the pick's top six protected this year. You know, so you get that early lottery pick, then you give up the pick they've owed the Celtics since Jeff Green was traded in 1927, I think. Give that up next year when it's, I think, top one protected or totally unprotected. I forget which. Well, they're going to be, unless they get really lucky in the lottery, they're going to be too good for that. And you know what, though? There is some benefit to having these really good young players, Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr. especially, Brandon Clark as well. But I think there's some big-time developmental benefit to having these guys play and compete in games that actually matter and to be able to compete for a playoff spot. And, man, that Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr. combo, that thing is clicking. Jaren Jackson Jr. has been awesome for well over a month. He's shooting more threes than twos. He's shooting over 50% from the floor, 40 plus from 3-point range. And then John Morant is just ridiculous. Not enough. That's kind of the one weakness. But man, those two, like, you're starting to see chemistry. You're starting to see, you know, the pick and roll with those guys really take off. The Grizzlies are interesting to me now, and I think 3 years from now they're going to be really – they got a chance to really be a good team.
I also – the word on the street is that they really do believe that they're going to find a trade for Iguodala.
They're adamant about that.
They've been adamant about it for months, but now that we are in the zone where they're actually having real talks, they – again, the what I feel in talking to people out there – is that they do think that's going to happen. And so
where?
Whether or not
– Where, Brian? Where?
Well, I think Dallas is an option. I don't want to get too far out over my skis on that. I know they've denied it. I know they've denied it. But
yeah.
I'm hearing different.
And look, high-ranking Mavericks folks denying stuff doesn't necessarily mean it ain't true. You know, it's Nelly back in the day had a great line. You know, I'm lying if my lips are moving.
But I actually have heard that some they've had some traction with some teams in the East. We've been really focused on teams in the West: Dallas, Denver, Clippers, Lakers. If there's a buyout, I've heard that they've got some traction on teams in the East. Now I don't know who those teams are. But we'll see. So
at some point he's got to play, you know?
Yeah, well, he will. I'm sure. I'm just saying, like, they may be able to add to that to what they've got on that team. Also, they've got Jay Crowder, who's eminently more tradable than Iguodala, because he only makes $7 or $8 million.
Something like that.
So. You know,
Crowder is a guy who, you know what, maybe there's a deal this summer where he stays in Memphis because they want smart, tough pros around this young core. You know, that's why they didn't try to move Crowder this summer. That's why they re-signed Valanciunas to a 3-year deal. You know, they never want to go and just straight up tank mode. And now, you know, they're actually competing. They're a competitive team.
I was just going to say, I was thinking about, because Dylan Brooks had a great game the other night. I was just thinking, remember that whole trade where they had the
– Yeah.
They were trading – they were arguing about the wrong Brooks. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the issue. They never wanted – like, even though Kelly Oubre has been terrific for the – he's really a most improved candidate in my mind. He's had a great year for the Suns, and he would have ended up in Memphis in that trade. Right. From what I understand, the Grizzlies never ever wanted to give Dylan Brooks.
Right.
Like they always believed.
Pretty good for them.
They always believed in his future, and that was the issue.
I mean, there's quite a difference between Marshawn Brooks and Dylan Brooks, my friends.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's an accurate statement. The Timberwolves, I think, are more likely to be sellers than anything. And the guy that I'm hearing out there that could be available is Robert Covington. Covington is an interesting player. He's on a pretty attractive contract. He's a 3-and-D guy who can play both forward spots. Good defender. You know, for example, if the Lakers could figure out a deal for Robert Covington, that would be a potentially huge move for them. That would probably have to involve Kyle Kuzma. And the Kuzma thing with the Lakers is interesting because, like, the Lakers, like, I've talked to some teams who tell me, no, Kuzma is available. The Lakers are willing to listen to offers for him. And then I've had other people say, oh, you know, they're saying they're not going to move Kuzma. I think the right deal is that I think they're going to move Kuzma. Now, Kuzma for Covington wouldn't work straight up, of course. Kuzma makes $2 million. Covington makes $11 million. But the Lakers have some pieces that they could add to it. They could put DeMarcus Cousins in there. They could put Troy Daniels. They could put Quinn Cook. They could do something there. You know, whether or not you want to cash in the Kuzma piece, who's got pretty interesting upside for a guy like Covington, is a completely other debate. But that's a type of deal they could make. And frankly, McMahon, this is why I'm going to bring up the Mavericks right now. Mm-hmm. The Mavericks, as I talk to teams around the league, the Mavericks are sounding like one of the most interesting teams coming towards the deadline for two reasons. One, they have an $11.8 million trade exception from the Harrison Barnes trade that expires the day after the deadline. And they're $12 million below the luxury tax. So I know they don't want to be a taxpayer this year because of what they have owed and going to have to pay going forward. But they could use that entire exception without going into the tax. And so that's interesting. And they also have Courtney Lee, a $13 million contract that they can use in a trade. So they have both of those options. And, I mean, they could, in theory, make two trades, one using the Lee contract and one using that trade exception. The other thing that I can already tell you is got a lot of value out there in the market is they have the Warriors' second round pick
from the Bogut trade to clear space for KD to sign in Golden State.
I promise the Warriors did not think that this was going to be a valuable asset. But
I also promise they don't regret that deal. It worked out okay for them.
100% true. Having said that, you know,
it is a much better chip than you. It's
going to be the 31st pick,
right?
Which is the best first round pick to have.
It's better than a late first round pick.
Yes, because you don't have to pay the guy as much. Yes, and you can get same quality player. That is a very highly desired pick. Now, the Mavericks, I think, are like, look, we'd like to keep that pick because they've traded away a bunch of their picks to New York. In fact, Dallas, I'm pretty certain, McMahon, isn't even allowed to trade a first-round pick. They couldn't even trade one if they wanted to because of the
– Yeah, they'd have to, like, eliminate the protection on the picks or whatever. Right. Yeah.
But they they actually have two second rounders. I think they have Utah's second rounder as well. When you talk to teams out there, and like, look, you're going to tell us what the Mavericks are telling you about this, but a lot of people, you know, look at the Mavs and go, you know, they're a pretty intriguing team. You know, they're in sixth place right now, but you know, they go on a win streak and they could be in fifth or fourth. They think that if they really wanted to, they could improve. And Covington's a name that I've heard come up in Dallas because Covington fits into that trade exception. And as you reported today, Porzingis just had PRP in his knee, and you know he provides. Even though he's not a player like Porzingis, he can play power forward and potentially protect you if Porzingis, you can't play Porzingis as much. So how do you digest everything I just rolled out there?
So, okay, there is, with the Mavericks, there is a thought of, hey, we've got this really good young team that's exceeded expectations. There is a good chemistry. Let's be careful about really disrupting that. And that's been the biggest pushback when it came to adding a guy like Iguodala, who would be a rental, who, you know, I mean, a lot of people expect Iguodala to run right back to Golden State after the season, so on and so forth. Covington would be a little bit different. And I was asking some scouts the other night about Covington, you know, just sitting courtside before a game, because, you know, everybody knows he's been floated in trade rumors and whatnot. And, you know, as a 3-and-D versatile guy, you said, he's a guy, if you're a playoff team, that's a really nice role player to have. One scout that I was talking to is saying, you know, he's really not playing very well this season, so on and so forth. And Dorian Finney-Smith was warming up at the time, and he pointed at Dodo, and he said, he's better than Covington right now. So, but, you know, they can both play together, and he is a guy who, you know, he shoots the three well. And
okay, I just Covington, pointing out, I like, Covington, I mean, I would it's not, say, you don't have to trade one for the other. I mean, they have a trade exception and this draft pick.
Right, but if Porzingis is on the floor, if Covington's going to start for the Mavericks, it would be Finney-Smith's spot that he takes. But I would also say Covington.
Okay, maybe it's not Covington. Maybe it's somebody else. I'm just saying as an example.
But Covington is also, to me.
Don't discount Covington back to Philadelphia.
Yeah? Boy, they could use him. They could use anybody who can shoot threes.
And don't think they don't have seller's remorse on him.
And let me tell you. I remember I went to Memphis to meet the Sixers the night they traded for Jimmy Butler, and obviously Covington went. And, man, Embiid at the time was like, boy, we're really, you know, man, Cove was a huge part of what we're doing. And Sarge to a certain extent, but really Covington was like, boy.
Yeah.
You know, well, he was a big part of what we're doing. Yeah. So that would make a lot of sense. And I'll say this, a guy like Covington, I think, is like – he is much better on a good team. Like, he's not a guy who's going to lift a bad team, but he's a guy who can really help a good team.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had a conversation with him. I was in Minnesota recently, and he was telling me how difficult last season was for him because he got traded midway through the year, and then he got hurt, and it was just like the worst year of his career. And I said to him, I was like, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this to him, but I said, I'm afraid you're a guy who's going to end up getting traded quite a bit in your career because all these teams want you.
Yeah.
You're a good defender. You can shoot. And, you know, right now you're on a contract that a lot of teams feel are attractive. And I was like, you might get traded a couple more times on this contract. I actually compared him right to him. I said, you know, you're kind of in that regard, kind of like Jay Crowder.
Yeah.
Everybody wants Jay Crowder, and his contract that he's been on for 5 years has been really attractive. And so he's gotten shipped from, you know, from Cleveland or, you know, to Boston, to Cleveland, to Utah, to Memphis. What would a Philly trade look like? They'd have to combine several.
Mike Scott would have to be in there, I would say. I mean, I don't have their roster.
Maybe Zaire Smith.
Yeah, Zaire Smith probably. I don't know what Mike Scott makes.
Philly has like some incredible number of second round picks. Hold on, Bobby Marks prepared us. But what Bobby Marks gives us internally? It's, you know, because he's essentially still working as a front office guy. He's just providing the stuff to us.
We should buy him a gift. Let's buy him a gift. I'm going to buy him a gift, and I'm going to make you guys chip in.
The 76ers have 9 second-round picks over the next 3 years. So when it comes to what they can do, for, you know, Utah just picked up Jordan Clarkson for 2 second-round picks. Mm-hmm. So to pick up now they also got off
and Dante Exum,
but the price of picking up a role player in some cases is, you know, a second round pick or two. Philly, I mean, you have to make the salaries match, but Philly has those assets to do that, to do those types of deals. That's why I think it's almost certain. I think if there's any team out there that I am most certain will make a trade, it's Philadelphia, even if it ends up being a small deal. Hey, you may have heard Jackie McMullen mention on the podcast recently about this piece that she worked on for months about the demise of the traditional center in the post-up play. Well, she went in depth about that on the ESPN Daily podcast with Mina Kimes, and how we may never see a dominant low post scorer again. So I'm going to go check that out, that episode out. And just in general, the ESPN Daily with Mina, she brings to you the best of ESPN every single day from the reporters who are on the ground doing the stories. It's certainly something that I enjoy. And by the way, as long as you're checking out podcasts, of course you should already be listening and already be subscribed to The Low Post. Zach Lowe has a podcast out with the Bleacher Report's Howard Beck, where they take a deep dive into some upcoming NBA trades. If you're interested in any of those subjects, I really recommend that you check out ESPN Daily or The Low Post right here or wherever you get your podcasts. So to go back to Dallas, you are on the belief that Dallas will what? Will stay put?
I'm not going to say they're not going to make a trade. I don't think the Mavericks do anything that drastically changes their roster. Like them being linked with Drummond, I would be absolutely shocked if Andre Drummond ends up in Dallas, and I think it would be an awful decision if he is.
Well, the thing, I think Dallas would be an interesting Kevin Love team, but there's just no way they're going to harm their 2021.
Yes, they are well positioned to be very aggressive in 2021, which is a 1 year window, because then obviously Luka's getting supermax on his second contract. But you know, they'll have Luka, they'll have Porzingis, you know, a bright future to sell and some cap space in 2021, and they are not going to do anything to harm that.
Let me ask you this, just for fun, because it's been out there. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of this, but what about the notion of Chris Paul to the Mavericks?
That kills 2021.
Yeah, I just can't. I can't see that. But you know, the 2021 also.
Okay, but I'm just saying, like, because Cuban doesn't care about money generally, right? Doesn't care about money.
But he cares about cap space. I mean, he stripped down a championship team for cap space to go chase Dwight Howard. It was Chris Paul at the time, right. A long time ago. Chris Paul would solve the Mavericks' biggest problem. That's that this most efficient offense in NBA history completely goes to crap in crunch time.
Exactly.
Where Chris Paul's the best closer in the league right now. And by the way, 2 years ago in Houston, they didn't play a lot of clutch minutes, but he was just as dominant. They just blew most teams out. But I would be shocked by that. And then, I'm not going to say Oklahoma City wouldn't trade them, but I don't think Oklahoma City's going to make a bunch of moves. I don't think there's going to be any kind of fire sale in OKC before the deadline.
I agree with that, but I still think Oklahoma City is open to moves that make sense for them. I know that there's been some discussion because they've played so well. Oh man, maybe they just leave this team alone. If you call, they're not going to do anything crazy like attach a first round pick to move Chris
right.
Paul. But if you call with a real offer for Chris Paul, Chris Paul's playing like an all-star right now. If you call and make an offer that's, competitive, I think they would consider doing it.
But the other thing, just like the CP3 Dallas thing, just pure, his salary is so big. Are you trading Porzingis for him? You're not going to
There's a whole bunch
of Tim Hardaway and a combination of Tim Hardaway and some junior and somebody else, right?
Yeah, which I just, like I said, I would be very, very surprised because it would punt their 2021. Are you taking the ball out of Luka's hands? I mean, it's a lot of changes for a team that's going, that's all, all things considered, is far ahead of expectations.
Well, Covington would impact 2021 space as well, but that's a guy that if you needed to move later on, you could. Mm-hmm. I would also, real quick before we go here, watch the Clippers as well. I think the Clippers are in the market. There's no doubt that they have interest in Marcus Morris. Had things gone differently in free agency for them, I think they might have signed Marcus Morris last summer. So I would watch. I would if New York decides to make a move, I think the Clippers would be at the front of the line there. But
they're also obviously in on Iguodala.
Yeah, yeah. So. Keep an eye on that. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jackie and McMahon. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody, and enjoy it.
Adios, amigos.